With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Proposed rules for irrigation runoff raise concerns among wine grape growers. California growers in Mendocino and Sonoma counties say proposed water quality regulations for waste discharge requirements for vineyards are burdensome, costly, and often duplicate work by growers participating in sustainability certification programs. Mendocino County wine grape grower Frost Pauly says vineyard farmers are concerned about proposed grower monitoring and reporting mandates being developed as part of the state's irrigated lands regulatory program. Proposed new rules focus on nitrogen applications and removals. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. CARB standards set the stage for nationwide rules. Often, California is the leader when it comes to agriculture production and new technologies, but Matt Clark, analyst with Terrain Ag, says that also goes for regulations. Clark talks to the implications of zero-emission truck rules in other ag-producing states.
One of the interesting things about the California Air Resources Board, or CARB, is oftentimes they kind of set the tone for the rest of the country. And there's a number of states that historically have gone right along with CARB, or soon thereafter adopt similar type of regulations, whether that's Oregon and Washington, or whether it's, you know, maybe it's out on the East Coast. But generally, the standard is somewhat set by CARB, and years later, you start to see kind of a rollout through the rest of the country. So I live in central Kansas, to your point. I see a lot of cattle hauling. We have a lot of feedlots. We do not have a large electric grid. And I just started asking the question of, what would happen if Kansas and Nebraska had to figure this out too? Where would we be? California is at the tip of the spear, but we may only be a handful of years behind. We don't know, obviously, but it's possible. And that starts to get really, really complicated. So, you know, if you think about feedlots and dairies, not all that dissimilar from California. They're normally in rural areas. They're normally in areas that are smaller populations, don't have a lot of EV access at the moment. So not only is there an infrastructure cross, but there's a concern of the fact there's only a handful of packers. So if you're a feedlot, you may only deal, you're, at the moment, you may have access to a number of packers, but you can't stop with the truckload of 1,400 pound cattle. You can't stop for a really long time and load up. I mean, there will be a cost to that. There's some animal welfare kind of concerns there. So that may shrink the radius in which you can operate with packers. So if maybe you go from five packers in an easy day haul to two, now you have to rethink your kind of system, what you're doing, what does basis look like, what's your relationship with those packers? Because it really kind of makes a larger dependency upon those.
You can find Clark's full report titled, Is the Agriculture Sector Charged for a Transportation Change? By visiting terrainag.com. And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
Several factors are contributing to a slowdown in the wine market. President of Allied Grape Growers, Jeff Bitter, said one of the challenges has been attracting new consumers to the industry.
We've struggled with keeping core and marginal consumers, but also attracting new consumers into those categories. And then, of course, we have challenges that everybody experiences in all industries currently, which include inflation, rising price of wine, and which, as we all know, price goes up, demand goes down. And that's simple supply and demand economics. So we're experiencing that. We're experiencing rising interest rates, which has caused the business to slow down. That is generally the impetus behind rising interest rates, is you want to slow an economy down. You want to counter inflation. Those things are happening, but it is at the expense of wine shipments. And so you have wineries that are investing less in growing programs or developing new product. So there's a lot of factors that are kind of contributing to the slowdown in the marketplace.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, House Agriculture Committee Chairman Glenn G.T. Thompson confirmed Monday that he wants House leadership to schedule floor time for the farm bill before he releases a draft of the bill or holds a markup. Thompson said he believes he'll be ready to release the draft at the end of August and plans a markup in mid-September, but only if leadership has told him what week the bill will be scheduled to come up on the House floor. Barring an unusual event, the House right now is not scheduled to return until September 12th. House members would have 12 legislative days after that to fund the government, which could include a series of short-term extensions. Chairman Thompson was in Minnesota for a Farm Bill listening session at Farm Fest in Morgan, Minnesota on Wednesday. Several Minnesota leaders spoke at the event. Minnesota Farm Bureau President Dan Glessing expressed concerns about CRP.
Certainly a good program on those sensitive lands that need protection. But how do we, in the Farm Bill, make sure that that is utilized on those sensitive acres and not taking good productive farmland out of production, as well as the rates? Certainly the rates are becoming concerning to farmers. It's a competition for that land, and in particular young farmers. As I have young farmers or children that I hope will come back to the farm one day and looking to expand, that's definitely a challenge when you're competing against the CRP rates. So keep that in mind as this Farm Bill goes forward, that it's a competition.
Lori Stevermer, president-elect of the National Pork Producers Council, talked about the impact of Prop 12 in California.
Proposition 12 is a far-reaching piece of legislation from California. There should be no way that the people in California tell Minnesota pig farmers how to raise pigs. Amen. Our concern is the cost of... Our concern is the cost of complacency, or a cost of to comply, would cause small and medium farmers to have to leave the business and have more consolidation. The patchwork of regulations that could happen across 50 states would be hard for us.
Nate Hultgren is the chairman of the board for the Southern Minnesota Beet Sugar Cooperative, and he thanked members for their support of the sugar program.
First off, I'd just like to thank members of the committee for fighting off some of your some of the good work you've done to fight off anti-sugar amendments and appropriations bills.
Lucas Schulstrom, the executive director of Minnesota Milk, said dairy producers are currently in a challenging position.
We are in a challenging place right now on prices, but also in a place of distrust and ethical questions between dairy farmers and processors. Federal milk marketing orders help regulate this. But we need changes. We need flexibility to ensure our orders serve farmers, and we need fairness in contracting. Basic things we've taken for granted, like written contracts, verification of weights and measures, and getting paid twice per month as we've all come to expect. We have a proposal that would help us do this, and we'd love to talk more with all of you about that.
Allison O'Toole, CEO of Second Harvest Heartland, a food bank based in the Minneapolis area, stressed the importance of the SNAP program.
We need a farm bill that strengthens and modernizes the SNAP component. Food bankers are some of the strongest SNAP advocates you'll find because we understand that we could never meet the need for food assistance through the charitable food system. Last year, we distributed 113 million meals across the heartland. Yet for every meal distributed by a food bank, SNAP provides 9. Any effort to reduce SNAP access and participation is sure to increase visits to food shelves and meal programs that are already struggling to keep up with demand.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, for the U.S. Meat Export Federation, a primary market development objective in Mexico is to strengthen U.S. pork identification in the retail and food service sectors. With more on that, here's John Harris.
In Mexico, the largest destination for U.S. pork exports, the U.S. Meat Export Federation differentiates U.S. pork as top quality through a marketing program that guarantees no water or other enhancements are injected into the product. USMEF Regional Director Gerardo Rodriguez recently updated pork industry leaders on the program.
I will just give a little bit of context regarding the pure pork. We have been working on this effort to identify the quality on the product per se. We know and we understand that there is no regulations from the government to identify and label the pork that is being injected or whatever you want to call it. So they put the amount of water that they want. There's no regulation on that. So we want to work with those companies and those distributors selling the product the natural way in the fact that it's no manipulated, right? No injected, no marinated, no water added, nothing, nada. Just the way it is. Because if we don't do something right now, we are going to be paying in the future when people get used to that modified product and the bite is different, the taste is different, everything is different. So we develop this pure pork program.
With the pure pork program achieving success in the retail sector in Mexico through a nationwide partnership with Costco, USMEF is now expanding the program into the food service sector.
We start this program in the retail sector. So we get a commitment with Costco nationwide. And they are carrying the pure pork program in Mexico. Now we're doing this in the food service. This expansion has been great. Actually, we started in a pilot program in the north of Mexico in Monterrey. We moved to Mexico City. Now we are in Guadalajara and we'll be moving to Chihuahua. So we're moving around in the food service. And this is not only a marketing activity, it is putting the seed in the industry for the future in Mexico.
For more information, please visit USMEF.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harith.
Thanks, John. And the National Milk Producers Federation says the Food and Drug Administration's plant-based beverage proposal falls woefully short of ending the decades-old problem of misleading plant-based labeling using dairy terminology. In comments to the FDA on the proposal, NMPF emphasized the importance of transparent product labeling to ensure consumer understanding. Their president and CEO, Jim Mulhern, said FDA's draft guidance is an encouraging first step towards promoting labeling transparency in the marketplace, but it's not enough. In its comments, NMPF commended FDA for its acknowledgement of consumer confusion over the nutritional content of dairy imitators, but NMPF cautioned FDA to adhere to the law by going through the proper legal process as outlined in NMPF's citizen petition and comments. Because of the voluntary nature of the proposed guidance and FDA's undependable labeling enforcement history, NMPF continues its work in Congress to pass the Dairy Pride Act. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
We want everyone to breathe clean, healthy air, but California's traffic and mountains don't make it easy. Our mountains trap pollution, making us more vulnerable to dirty air. Today's farmers are voluntarily doing their part with help from USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. How? By replacing older diesel-powered tractors and equipment, treating dusty farm roads, avoiding open burning, and more. Can't afford it? NRCS has invested $178 million helping California farmers clean our air. They can help you too. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Honeybee losses continue. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. A new USDA report on U.S. honeybee colonies shows continued high losses of those colonies. Gary Crawford reports.
It seems the nation's honeybee colonies continue to be under siege. The latest USDA report shows the number of colonies down from a year ago, the number of colony losses up. Now, last year, USDA reported that on January 1st of 2022, the number of colonies was only down from the year before by 1%. But on January 1st of this year, the number of colonies down by 7% at just under 2.7 million. And the downward pressure has continued into 2023. USDA reports the number of colonies colonies lost during the January through March quarter, that number up by 14%. Colonies lost with symptoms of colony collapse disorder, those losses are up by 25%. What's going on with the bees? Chris Hyatt's president of the American Honey Producers Association. He thinks there are multiple causes.
Varroa mite, passing viruses, there's way less forage, climate change with drought.
And possibly some issues with pesticides, too. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen. Most farm leases are oral. While that may be convenient, it does increase the likelihood that legal issues will occur between the landlord and the tenant. A recent court decision demonstrates the possible peril of not putting a farm lease in writing. In the case, Dad owned a large farm but lived out of state. His son lived on and managed the farm. The son would get the neighbor to cut a 107-acre hayfield when it was needed, and they would split the bales after harvest. It was just a verbal arrangement. After a couple of years, the neighbor wrote out a document stating that he had a 5-year hay lease, had the son sign it, and filed it with the local FSA office. The son understood that the document was just so the neighbor could get the government payments on the hay ground. Shortly thereafter, the father was approached with a deal to put solar panels on the field, and the neighbor was told the hay wouldn't need to be cut anymore. The neighbor sued for breach of a lease. The court disagreed. The writing didn't have the basic terms of a lease contract. It was just a document stating that he had a lease, but there wasn't any written lease agreement. And the son gave credible testimony that he never even entered into an oral lease with the neighbor. It was merely an agreement to cut hay. Get your lease arrangements in writing to reduce your legal risk. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen.
Farmers, you might actually remember when the big data revolution started in agriculture.
Years ago, probably the initial source of big data was on harvesters. Yield monitors were one of our first big data generation machines that we had on farm.
And Kendall Kirk of Clemson University also reminds us that when this first step in the evolution of big data on the farm took place,
the cloud computing opportunities where cost has gone down to enable some of that, those weren't there. Connectivity was not there.
So if a producer wanted data from their harvesters and their yield monitor displays,
it wasn't to put it on a jump drive. Instead, it was to put it on an SD card, and in some cases, floppy drives even prior to that.
To say the systems of agricultural big data and the tools used to collect it have come a long way is perhaps an understatement, especially with advances in connectivity.
And all of a sudden now you've got not only data coming from a yield monitor that shows you, for instance, during grain harvest, how much grain did you harvest from this area of the field versus that area of the field. But now we have sensors on our planters. We have sensors on our irrigation systems. We have soil moisture sensors that we install in the field. We have soil information that we collect with machines such as electrical conductivity.
Another evolution in big data has been how this information is managed. Kirk acknowledges that out of necessity, as technology advanced, most big data was collected initially through proprietary systems, proprietary as in company, and by piece of equipment, creating proprietary silos at first.
It's sort of been an organic growth of how it needed to develop. And now what we're seeing in the ag side is similar to what I think we've seen a lot of energy directed towards ISO bus on connecting implements to tractors, to where we have sort of standard communication across those machines. And we're starting to see the same thing on some of the data.
Current developments and research in agricultural-oriented big data include a project called AgRec. Kirk describes it as an open-source data resource containing shared cooperative extension resources and information that a community or the world could share without going into an extension office or reading a physical manual. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
GMOs? Genetically engineered? Bioengineered? What's what? Well, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. It's the common term many people use for foods created through a process scientists call genetic engineering. And you'll start seeing bioengineered on some food packages. to let you know the product or some of its ingredients come from GMOs. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
It was a week ago today, the last time corn futures closed higher. I'm Mark Oppel with today's bottom line report brought to you by Helena. Seven lower closes in a row on December corn, taking the futures back to lowest since July 13th. A daily low then, 474. USDA's August crop report is a week from tomorrow. Early private estimates nearly guarantee that someone is going to be surprised. Two major firms have released updates this week, one showing a national average corn yield 176.3, another actually increased their July estimate by a half a bushel, 178.4. We think that that 177-178 number is where USDA will land next week. Kansas City wheat starts today, the lowest since June 14th, and looks to find some support today. This is the bottom line report. Wall Street remains uneasy after the U.S. credit rating was lowered from AAA to AA+. We'll watch 35,000 on the Dow today and tomorrow to see if that level holds. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
What role does the USDA play in crafting a new farm bill? What has been USDA's role in the farm bill process? Gary Crawford tells us.
The process of crafting a new farm bill is into its final key phase now. What's been the USDA's role in this process?
Having served as a U.S. representative, I know that it's Congress that writes the farm bill.
Not the USDA. Deputy Agriculture Secretary Sochil Torres-Small told us that a few administrations in the past have written their own versions of farm bills and pushed those to lawmakers. She says that's not the approach of this administration instead.
USDA stands ready and is very much engaged in providing technical assistance and making sure that we serve as a voice for farmers and ranchers and rural people and people who depend on SNAP and our mini nutrition programs.
Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And the American Carbon Alliance has a new coalition coming together to talk about the benefits of carbon capture technologies. Here's Chad Smith with the report.
The group is led by CEO and Executive Chairman Tom Bias, former CEO of Growth Energy and President of the National Farmers Union. He says the alliance was formed to talk about the benefits of the technology to everyone in rural America.
Everyone from the farmers that grow the corn to ethanol producers and the communities that these plants reside in. Oftentimes the debate has been about a lot of emotional issues and not necessarily about the benefits. So we created an alliance, and this alliance is to bring in everybody and anyone who's involved in the carbon capture industry in rural America to talk about these benefits. We just want them to be part of the debate, not exclusively based on emotional issues.
He talks about some of the specific benefits that carbon capture offers to rural America.
It lowers the carbon index for the production of ethanol, and the production of ethanol then qualifies for any future fuels. Sustainable aviation fuel, for example, is a potential 100 billion gallon market worldwide, and the airline companies are all under the gun to reduce their carbon score, and ethanol won't qualify as a feedstock to produce sustainable aviation fuel unless we get our carbon index down. So the ripple effect backs it up, where you have less demand for corn, and less demand for corn usually leads to oversupply. Oversupply leads to lower prices to the farmer. That's what we're seeking to avoid.
Bias says a lot of carbon exits an ethanol plant through its smokestack.
So they capture that carbon going up the smokestack. They process it and compress it, and it's shipped through pipelines to areas of the country where you can safely store it, where it has some structure to be able to put it into the ground and cap it and keep it forever. In the Midwest, Those two locations right now are North Dakota and Illinois. And so you have a wide swath of the ethanol industry that's located in between those two locations. And so you have to get it to the areas that the rock formation will allow to be kept.
Pipeline placement and construction has been a hot button issue recently. Bias says many people may not realize that there are millions of miles of pipelines around the country.
Shipping carbon by pipeline is the most efficient manner. It's the safest manner. If you had to rail or truck carbon, it's a lot more dangerous transportation mode than pipelines. And pipelines can be safely put into the ground. And I think all the companies involved, and there's several companies that are building pipelines, have all said that they were going to ensure that the yield capability of the land where the pipelines go. They're offering huge lease payments to farmers. And I think what you ultimately will see is the pipelines approved and moving forward to the areas of the country that can store it.
For more information, go to AmericanCarbonAlliance.org. Chad Smith reporting.
The Agriculture Department's final agricultural trade mission of 2023 is scheduled for late October and early November. The destinations? Two growing Southeast Asian markets, Singapore and Malaysia. And as the U.S. delegation's lead official, Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs Alexis Taylor notes,
they are showing a lot of interest and demand in U.S. food and agricultural products. And we are excited to take these businesses and U.S. industry to really explore the opportunities that are there for them.
So in the case of Malaysia,
in 2022, U.S. exports reached $1.1 billion to Malaysia. It's a growing market. We are sending products such as wheat, rice, beef, dairy, and a lot of different fruits, but also we see growing demand for soybeans, some processed fruit and vegetable products, tree nuts, and then also just consumer packaged goods, things that are going directly to consumers. We see a growing middle class, more disposable income, and a really desire to buy those U.S. food and ag products directly.
While in the case of Singapore,
we saw 190% growth from 2012 to 2022, reaching a record in 2022 of $1.4 billion. Just a really exciting market. I think they're a sophisticated market and a lot of like U.S. consumer packaged goods, those products that are going directly to consumers as a high income country.
Beyond interest of these markets of U.S. farm and food goods is both Malaysia's and Singapore's positions in trade within the Southeast Asian marketplace.
Malaysia is a major food processing hub in the region, and they do a lot of re-exporting through Southeast Asia and beyond. When we look to Singapore, they are a highly urbanized nation, and they rely heavily on agricultural food imports. They are a key logistics hub to the Asia-Pacific region, and they host a lot of buyers from the whole region in Singapore. And so Singapore is a market that we are interested in, but getting into the Singapore market, you really are able to tap into that entire region.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Why do you listen?
Anytime I'm talking to a friend about new music and I don't know what it is, it's probably because they were listening to radio and I wasn't.
I'm nosy. I like to know what's going on, and radio usually is right there telling me what and when is going on and where it's going on.
Well, listen in the barn, skid loader, tractor, then just about anywhere you can.
When you put the lights on the barn, the radio went on.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
In today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California, you can find them online at almonds.com. And today we're bringing you a conversation between Director of Operations for Campos Brothers Farms and Chair of the Board of Directors for the Almond Board of California, Alexi Rodriguez, and ABC Senior Specialist of Industry Communications, Taylor Hillman.
We're going to talk today about the recent announcement, the new president and CEO for the Almond Board of California. For those who don't know, back in November of 2022, Richard told the board that he was going to leave at the end of this year. to pursue some other things. And that began the kind of search into looking for the new president and CEO of the Almond Board. You have been involved in this, obviously, all along the way. And so things kicked off with announcing a group that would kind of lead the charge, and then bringing in an executive search firm to help aid that search. It's been quite the process, although I will say it doesn't seem like it's been that long. So it seems like things went really well, considering this started off in November and we're only 8 months past that. So let's talk a little bit about the interaction with the executive search firm. So I don't think most people will have the experience of dealing with an executive search firm. So what goes into that? What direction was given to them? How much input was given to them? What was that like to start the search and start looking for someone for this role?
Yeah, the firm that we worked with was Russell Reynolds, and the search committee and I, very early on in the process, decided that we didn't want to be so specific that we would potentially miss out on candidates. So we tried to be fairly broad, but also make sure that this candidate had some of the key components. The most important being experienced with in strategic leadership, with an emphasis on marketing and driving global demand.
That's great. And a little bit about, you know, trying to keep that broad so we have a wide net, really, is what we're looking at here. Was there any sort of preference on inside the industry, familiarity with the industry, outside of the industry? I could see there being some plus and minuses for both. Did that factor in at all?
No, we went into this process very open-minded, and what was most important was that we find the right candidate.
So the new president and CEO is Clarice Turner. Clarice is most recently with a Napa Valley winery, Joseph Phelps Vineyards. She was with Boudin Bakery, Starbucks Company, Yum Brands, Papa Murphy's, PepsiCo. Those are some big names, Alexi. Talk about the fact that she's got that marketing background, but also that experience. I mean, this is the experience you look for with representing a global brand. I mean, that's pretty important when looking at filling this role, right?
Exactly. The stars sort of aligned for us. We knew that we were going to be asking a lot of this CEO, and so it was inherent that the candidate would have some deep executive experience. Lucky for us, Clarice has everything that we were looking for and then some.
When you look at maybe specific experiences, was there things that stood out with Clarice or leadership roles that she held that was especially intriguing?
You know, Clarice's resume speaks for itself. We could probably go on and on just about how impressive she is as a candidate. You know, she was head of global food at Starbucks. Her most recent role at Joseph Phelps, she did a great job in getting them ready to sell. What really stood out to us was that not only does she have all this wonderful experience, but Clarice actually has a personal connection to the Central Valley. And she is incredibly passionate about California agriculture. And so it's her passion coupled with the experience that she has that really made her stand out very early in the process.
Yeah, we also heard she had some connection to the growing side of things too. So that's exciting. It seems like a great pick. With the announcement of the firm in March and then the announcement coming out that she has been chosen and she has accepted the position, that moved 3 or 4 months, that moved fairly quickly for this type of position. All in all, 8 months. It sounds like it was a pretty efficient process. Was there anything that surprised you along the way? Anything that you noticed that was maybe you didn't think it was going to go that way?
Yes and no. I was actually surprised at how efficient the process was. When we first started, there was a lot of just unknowns. You know, we have had the good fortune of having Richard for 21 plus years. So we wanted to be really intentional about how we framed this position for the next CEO. And then we wanted to be sure we gave ourselves enough time to find the right person. And so there was a lot of back and forth on how long this search should take. And ultimately what we decided on is, okay, we were going to aim for the end of this crop year. And that way that gave us a little bit of runway between when Richard announced his retirement and if we needed some more time to find the right candidate. Lucky for us, we've found our candidate almost to the date of when we were hoping to find, now in this case, her. And we are fortunate to have some time for her to learn the industry before Richard's eventual departure at the end of this year.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys kind of nailed your timing. So good job on that. And her having the time with Richard, I think that is only beneficial. So it'll be a seamless transition, I am sure. Anything else you want to add? Anything else about Clarice or anything else about the success of the search, the people who helped? Anything else you want to add here?
Yeah, I am really honored that the board and the industry entrusted me with leading this search. The search committee and I were uncompromising in our process, and I believe the results speak for themselves. We are incredibly excited to see what Clarice brings to the industry for years to come.
Well, it sounds like you did a wonderful job. Again, we're talking with Alexi Rodriguez, Director of Operations for Campos Brothers Farms and Chair of the Board of Directors for the Almond Board of California. Alexi, thank you for taking some time with us.
No problem. Thank you.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. The enrollment deadline for CDFA's manure programs are quickly approaching. Dairy farmers have just until the end of the month to apply for a manure management grant through the Office of Environmental Farming and Innovation at the California Department of Food and Agriculture. Farmers can apply in three different programs, including the Alternative Manure Management Program, the Dairy Digester Research and Development Program, and new this year is the Dairy Plus Program. Funding for the AMMP and the DDRDP come from the Budget Act of 2022, and funding for the Dairy Plus Program comes from USDA's Partnership for Climate Smart Commodities Program. The primary goal of each project should be to fund the installation of equipment and the implementation of practices that result in long-term methane emission reduction and to maximize the environmental co-benefits. The deadline for these three grant programs is August 28th. Grant awards will be up to $2.85 million per project. If you'd like to find out more information on each program and to apply, you can visit cdfa.ca.gov/OEIF.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is offering a new opportunity for experienced food systems and supply chain professionals. USDA has entered into a cooperative agreement with the Federation of American Scientists to establish a new Food Supply Chain Impact Fellowship. The new program allows participants to gain experience in federal government and to support the implementation, coordination, and oversight of USDA's food systems transformation efforts. The Federation of American Scientists is accepting applications for the fellowship until August 7th. Impact Fellows will provide coordination, technical assistance, and support to the USDA Regional Food Business Centers, the Resilient Food Systems Infrastructure Program, and other food systems transformation efforts. Information about the fellowship and how to apply is available on the Federation of American Scientists Food Supply Chain Impact Fellowship webpage. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
A slow start to Western wildfire season in 2023.
For the United States as a whole, we got well into July before we saw extensive wildfire activity.
Yet over the last week of July, a pickup in wildfire activity.
according to USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
And that has finally pushed the year-to-date wildfire acreage in the United States past the 1 million mark. As of the end of July, we have seen just about 1.2 million acres burned across the United States. That is still significantly below the 10-year average of just about 3.8 million acres for the first 7 months of the year.
The pickup in wildfire activity has occurred primarily in California and Nevada, although most of the current fire map includes several small fires in the desert southwest. Two notable complexes are also currently active in the Pacific Northwest. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
USDA releases the 2022 Farm Expenditures Report. At the end of July, the Department of Agriculture released the 2022 United States Total Farm Production Expenditures Summary. Farm production expenditures in the United States are estimated at $452.7 billion. That's up from $392.9 billion the previous year. The 2022 total farm production expenditures are up 15.2% compared to 2021 total farm numbers. The four largest expenditures totaled $219.6 billion, accounting for 48.5% of total expenditures in 2022. These include feed at 18.5%, farm services at 10.8%, livestock, poultry, and related expenses at 10.1%, and labor at 9.2%. In 2022, the United States' total farm expenditure average per farm is $226,986. That's up 15.8% from 2021. On average, United States farm operations spent $41,917 on feed, $22,864 on livestock, poultry, and related expenses, $24,469 on farm services, and $20,858 on labor. California contributed most to the 2022 United States total expenditures, with expenses of $46 billion. Iowa, the next leading state, had $35.7 billion in expenses. NASD contributed to that report.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.